I'm gonna do the talking. Yes, I'll do the walking. I'm gonna find me a comfy spot and just wait the whole thing out. Time gonna do the talking. Yes, I'll do the walking. Time gonna tell you, baby, what you can hear now.
For more than 40 years, Betty LaVette was the greatest R&B singer that no one knew. 16 when she debuted with the hit single My Man, He's a Lovin' Man in 1962, the Detroit native was ready, willing, and able to ride the tsunami of pop music cresting in the Motor City. But it never happened. Time and again falling victim to what she calls her buzzard luck, LaVette continued recording and performing in relative obscurity until well past 50, she finally began to gain the attention she long deserved. In 2008, she took the nation's breath away at the Kennedy Center Honors, and in 2009, she wowed the crowd at the Lincoln Memorial as part of President Barack Obama's pre-inaugural concert. The singer, who repeatedly couldn't get a record deal, now enjoys multiple Grammy nominations and regular engagements at New York's exclusive Cafe Carlyle. She is also the author of her autobiography, A Woman Like Me. It's a great pleasure to welcome Betty LaVette to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a thrill.
Oh, thank you for having me, baby. That sounds great. Say it again.
we love having you here and what you have accomplished. And it's beautiful to see you getting this recognition now. Are you having fun with it?
Well, I don't know about fun. It's more, you know, I think that probably had I been doing something else for these whole 50 years and then suddenly they called, it would be kind of a fun, surprising, exciting thing. But I've been working directly toward this, and I certainly didn't think that these things that have happened of late would happen. But I'm more relieved than anything. You know, I thought that I would die broke and obscure. I'm just going to die broke, but I will die obscure now. So, yeah, I'm so pleased for that. You know, all of my school friends and neighbors and buddies in Detroit are known by all of my school friends and neighbors and buddies. But I, just until just 8 or 9 years ago, I knew the addresses and telephone numbers of all of my fans.
It seems as though you personify the old saying of for every step forward, you take a couple steps back, that you would hit an incredible high, something amazing would happen, and then you would have a down, you would have a low.
Yeah, but I don't agree with the back, because there's no way in the world that had I become a star, I would be as proficient an artist as I am. So every time I took a step forward, then I would have to stand still. This is actually just my second step. They let me have those early records, many of which charted, but I continued to learn and I continued to grow as an artist. And now they're letting me take the second step. It's very, very strange that it has taken me 50 years to take the second step, but this is indeed the second step. I've never stopped singing, and I've never stopped growing.
When you say they are now letting me take the second step, is that who they are?
No, the industry. The audience, anytime, all of this other stuff, the recording, the Kennedy Center thing, the book, all of that is gravy. All I wanted was an agency. I knew that if I had a booking agency, every audience I've ever had in my life, I've kept. It's just that my audiences have been very, very small, and because it's taken such a long time, and they were primarily up until now an all-black audience, half of them were dead by the time this happened, and I was half dead, you know. So it has been a very long time in garnering this audience. But the things that you mentioned in your piece before are the things that have helped me go on and take the full second step, or I would have continued to just keep collecting 100 people every 5 years or something. And of course, I'm running out of time, and I wasn't collecting them fast enough. So now I'm able to collect them faster, and television and anything like that, the book, all of that helps. and I'm finally being lavished with what I call my Ray Charles audience. I can look at my audience now, and there's some of everybody, old and young, and black and white and Asian and everything.
You write in
and
the,
that's what I've always wanted.
Which is beautiful that you now have it. You write in the book about Motown, and why was that elusive to you, do you think, of not being able to be brought into Berry Gordy's stable of Motown stars?
My goodness, I didn't know that. That's the way you understood it? No, I when I started singing, baby, I started with Atlantic. In 1962, Berry Gordy wanted to be with Atlantic. That was the biggest black record concern in the world. And that was where the Coasters and Ray Charles and everybody was. That was where everybody wanted to be. I only wanted to be with Motown any time what I was doing did not work. I never had any great desire to be there until everything else had been exhausted. There was nothing like leaving Detroit and going and signing with a company in New York. Only Jackie Wilson, Aretha Franklin, Della Reese, and I did that. And everybody else was with Motown. Motown, when I started, was a small local company. Berry was distributing his records almost by hand. You know, I was with Atlantic. There was no, I wasn't trying to get on the inside of there. And I was very involved romantically with a producer there, so I was as inside of it as I wanted to be.
You broke your contract with Jerry Wexler's Atlantic Records. When you felt they were just not utilizing you the way that you felt they should be, what was not happening that you felt should be happening?
Joe, honey, I was 16 years old, about turning 17. I had no idea what they should have been doing. I had never had anything or been anywhere. I stupidly listened to friends who said, you should have another record by now. They should be doing this. Look what they're doing for this one and that one. And I went and demanded my contract, and Jerry Wexler just looked at me with just, you poor baby. He wrote me his own personal check for $500. He said, you're going to need this. And he was so absolutely right. I think that's the biggest mistake that I ever made in my life. There was absolutely no reason for me to leave. I had never had a record before that. I don't know why I couldn't wait until they got me another one.
In the pattern, in reading the book, the pattern becomes familiar in that somebody would recognize your abilities, your amazing voice, how incredible you are, record an album, and then for one reason or another, as you say in the book, the sugar would turn to shit.
Absolutely. And it's really always been so. I've never been strung out on drugs or late for my gigs or disruptive in the studio. So none of those things ever happened with me. It was like the company would just like disappear overnight, or my manager got shot and then eventually died. Another record company president disappeared, and I found years later that he had also been murdered. It was things, you know, like that, or the people, the production company I'd signed with couldn't finish the deal with the big company they were trying to go with. It was all kinds of things like that, you know, not your regular things. Just really, that's why my mother started to call it buzzard luck, which meant that it was like unusual bad luck. You know, it wasn't the regular bad luck that everybody else had.
You talk about in the book, I mean, you certainly would use marijuana, you would drink, but nothing that everybody else wasn't doing. And not so much.
Oh, no, I mean, I did what everybody else was doing. Nobody was. I never had enough money to buy any cocaine, so only blue cocaine if I was with the people who were making money. And it was a thing that virtually everyone, people greeted each other in the day in from about 1965 to about 1975. People greeted each other with, "Hey man, how you doing? One-on-one." You know, that was a part of the greeting. You know, so I certainly wasn't doing anything that anybody else wasn't doing, and to mess with heroin was to be a pariah. I mean, nobody on the inside, and we knew who the people were who messed with heroin. They were noted, and are duly noted in their books, Ray Charles, Etta James. That was about it. You know, that just wasn't a thing that we did. And certainly the people who were raising and handling me taught me the difference between the two and would never take me around it or, you know, that just never entered into the thing.
Being a soul singer, for you, how important, because church was never of great importance when it came to the singing and the craft.
No, I was raised in a Catholic church. But, you know, certainly if you're black in America, there's some gospel in your family, in your life somewhere. It's just that I wasn't raised with a church-going, you know, a gospel-singing, church-going family. While my mother did love gospel music, and when we lived in Western Michigan early on, when I was a small little baby, my parents sold corn liquor, and if you had to have a drink in that time, it was segregation. You had to come by my house; it was the only place you could go. So all the gospel singers, after their performances, came by there. So I certainly was privy to hearing the Soul Stirrers, the Pilgrim Travelers, and the Blind Boys of Mississippi, and the Swan Silvertones. All those people came by my house, so I heard them. Anytime you get a bunch of singers together, when they get drunk, they're going to sing. So I heard a lot of gospel through that. So there's certainly some in my voice, I'm sure, but mostly my voice is blue. It didn't come from singing in church and singing in the choir and whatever. My voice is more of a blue rhythm and blues voice than a gospel rhythm and blues voice. In, say, like by standards of, say, Della Reese, Aretha, Gladys Knight, who came straight from church.
At what point did you realize that you could sing? I mean, that you were good. You were better than most.
Oh, that took a very good maybe 30 years. But to realize that I could sing, that happened early on in that same setting there where my family sold the corn liquor. I learned all the songs on the jukebox that we had there in the living room, and they would stand me on top of it, and I could sing. They'd put money in the jukebox and give me a quarter, and I would sing right along with all the songs. We had country western songs, gospel songs. My mother was a great Red Foley and Hank Williams fan, and so I knew songs by them. I knew blues songs, and rhythm and blues was just coming on, so I knew songs. The Little Esther, she was called at the time, Esther Phillips, and there wasn't a lot of jazz. Jazz was. It was a little too sophisticated for Western Michigan and my family's corn liquor drinking crowd.
You write in the book with such honesty about people who made it in the business, people that you greatly admired and those that you didn't. And you know, we're used to reading compliments in books. It is striking when you hear somebody say something about somebody, like as you say about Diane Ross.
Well, it wasn't. You have to realize too, I'm not talking about who you know. I'm talking about who I know.
Right.
And that was that, you know, even with David Ritz and I, you know, he did a book on Marvin Gaye as well, but he did a book on the Marvin Gaye that he knew, not the one that I knew. So every time that he would interject something about Marvin, I'd say, I don't know that about him. The Marvin I knew barely raised his voice, was hilariously funny, and forever telling some kind of joke and talking about somebody or mimicking someone. Was just an extreme gentleman, blew about the same amount of cocaine as everybody else, you know, never, just a completely different person than the person that David Ritz knew and the person that his father shot. You know, so this was a completely, I doubt that Diane would get in a fight with anyone at this point, you know, I don't think she wanted to get in a fight that night, but, you know, that I'm talking about who I and these people were in 1962 and 63. After that, I never saw them anymore because, as you hear again, all of my sugar turned to shit. And there's not anything, I'm not saying anything about the them that you know because I don't know anything about them as stars. I mean, many of them I did see again. The Temptations, the Four Tops remained friends up until now, until they died. You know, and whenever I could, I would see them. But my manager, Jim Lewis, always told me, when you go to a dressing room door, if they don't know who you is, you ain't. So when I would go to one of their dressing room doors, if their new people didn't know who I was, I would just go away. I didn't hang around, and which is how I became involved. I wanted to be with people who could be in places with spending money and dressing well and whatever. So I couldn't get with them because I couldn't get in the dressing room. So I could get to the numbers men and to the people of the street and of the nightlife who made just as much money, who looked just as good and could take me. I could be seen, you know, under the auspices of Betty LeVette.
It is unbelievable when you hear a story. I mean, at least for us. I mean, obviously you've been in the industry for a long time, but you to read a story like James Brown not wanting you to sing a particular song while you were opening for him because it got too much applause.
Oh, he was a very spiteful man, and you know, the people, I think the people maybe that knew him later, but I think if you talk to, what's his name that did the put the flames together for him? If you talk to him and to the young woman that he was married to, in fact, when I was doing the show with them, they had just gotten married. And they told me that James did not know that they were married and that they could not tell him. You know, so now these were, I was right there with him in the dressing room door next to him. I put in my appointment to speak with him. I never got a chance to do so. And so, you know, that's what happened with me with James Brown. I don't know what happened with you with James Brown, but that's what happened with me with him. And almost anybody else that you would talk to from that period. I don't know who maybe he eventually became someone else, but that was who he was at that time.
He was on the show once, and he came in, and he talked to me for a half hour, and I don't know what he said.
Oh, I love it.
I
love it.
I really have no idea what he said.
I love it.
you have a great picture in the book of your meeting with Barack Obama in 2009, obviously singing at the inauguration. Oh, my God, it must have been quite a moment.
Oh, it was, and Joe, for me, if you think about the people who were on the inaugural thing, I was the only person there who was born in segregation besides Pete Seeger, and he was born under different auspices.
Right.
The president was the same age as my career. This was the first black president. This was the biggest audience that had ever seen me in my entire 40-something year career. I was standing at the feet of Abraham Lincoln. It was for me more than it was for anybody else on that show. Anybody.
And how long does it take to come down for something like that?
Well, nothing takes me to lofty heights anymore. I just feel more relieved. I feel more relieved. I'm still just as pleased about that today as I was that day. I'm absolutely pleased about it. It was my entire body. I was thoroughly, just the way you can have something hurt you and it hurt you so bad it hurt you all over. Well, I've had that too. But this was thoroughly pleasing. I was, every inch of me was pleased. And that, you know, is something that you can kind of hold on to for a long while. If you can hold on to something that made you angry or hurt you, I know you can hold on to something that made you feel good. And I had great room for that because the things that hurt me or whatever, I don't hold on to. I hold on to the deed, but I don't hold on to the feeling at all. I just throw the feeling on into a song.
You talk about being allowed to make that second step. So are you ready for step three, step four, step five?
Well, I'm good. I'm good to go for three and four. I don't know about five now. I mean, you know, I was telling my audience the other night, I said all of my contemporaries are singing the songs that when I was introducing the new CD here in New York week before last, I said, all of my contemporaries are singing the songs they've been singing for 20 years. You all know the words. You help them with them and sing them along with them. I said, I'm standing up here with trying to remember the words to this damn new album. I said, so if I look back here at this paper for every once in a while, I don't want to hear nothing from nobody. As soon as I learn them, I'll sing them.
The new album is Thankful and Thoughtful, which is gorgeous, absolutely beautiful.
Thank you so much. And I am thankful and thoughtful. I do think about it all the time. I'm the luck. This isn't happening to anybody else's grandmother anywhere in the world. It just really isn't.
Well, it's
a guy last week called me the Grandma Moses of soul. I said, I like it.
Well, it's a beautiful story, and you are just incredible. The name of the book is A Woman Like Me, and it is published by Blue Rider Press. Betty Levette, what an honor to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Baby, thank you so much for speaking with me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again,
thank you.
The new book is A Woman Like Me. It's published by Blue Rider Press. The new album is Thankful and Thoughtful from Anti Records. Betty Levette is the author of the book and, of course, has the new album out. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
I think I'd like to go back home and take it easy. There's someone that I'd like to get to know.